Must be a slightly different notation, say. P. And Q. Integral of theta 2a. And actually, these are periodic by large gauge transformations. So we want to compute the Poisson bracket. That PQ goes like 1 over K. And in fact, you know, there's some normalizing factors of pi and I that I'm really never great at getting totally right. So let's, the important thing is like 1 over K. And maybe we'll restore some factors of 2 pi I at some state. So why is this? To do this, we need to study the two-point function like this. So t equals 0, here's my torus. This is P and T, some other value, say T naught. This is Q. And I want to study the exchange of a gluon. And then the discontinuity is the Poisson bracket. So to do this, we do the usual trick. Let's solve the equations of motion in the presence of the operator. Integral t to 1, that's what I say. Integral theta 2 a. So the action is k times some factors of pi, which would be 2 pi, because 1 over 2 pi here probably. Plus the delta function . So this term here, where I've inserted a delta function along this line that we're integrating over, that is the insertion of this operator. So we're going to solve the equations of motion by varying a. So we're going to vary the theta 2 component of a. So the field strength in these directions is 1 over k times a delta function. So we can solve this equation by saying a solution a theta I is 0, sorry, a theta 2 is 0, a t is 0, and a of theta 1 is like minus 1 over k. Yes, that's probably a plus. So if the theta 1 component is a delta function along the line and along positive time with a factor of 1 over k. So let's draw this. Here's my torus. So this circle here is going to be the circle where theta 1 is 0. And this is going to extend into a cylinder. But the cylinder only goes for positive time, because it's a delta function of positive time times a delta function on the circle. So at any positive time, it's supported on that circle. OK, now we can commute the two-point function easily. So the Poisson bracket is going to be, we measure the Wilson line along, so we're not really Wilson line, it's along. We measure integral over theta 1, a theta 1, in the field sourced by this one. So we did it, we solved the equations of motion in the presence of this source, and then I measure what it does with the other operator. This is always how we do these things, and a general recipe for gauge theory or whatever. So the field sourced by this is this delta function. So we want to consider whatever PQ is going to be the integral. I hope I didn't get my theta 1s and theta 2s mixed up. Let me just check. Yeah, no, I don't think. Integral over theta 1, 1 over k times So what do we see? This is supposed to be happening at a fixed time. Some fixed positive time, and we're interested in the discontinuities as that time goes from positive to negative. So this is going to be a delta function where this time is positive. And when I integrate the delta function in theta, I just get 1. So this is like 1 over k delta t naught is positive. So we conclude that the Poisson bracket is 1 over k. OK, and as I said, I was not great about getting the normalizations all correct, but they're close enough. Okay, any questions about how we made this derivation? You look unhappy.
Yeah, because there you have pq, and it's 1 over k times delta, and then it's just 1 over k, so it's a bit confusing.
I just wrote it wrong. So pq is the discontinuity in this. So you take it for positive time minus negative time. Okay, this is good, but we can do a little better because this isn't really, these aren't really gauge invariant coordinates because large gauge transformations will shift them. The actual gauge invariant quantities are capital P and capital Q. And these correspond to actual Wilson lines. So we can compute an algebraic consequence of the Poisson bracket for the little q's, which we've actually mentioned before, is that for the big q's, the Poisson bracket is alternatively, if we promote the Poisson bracket to a commutator, we find PQ equals QP e to the 2 pi I over k. Okay. And I've been extremely sloppy, as I mentioned, about factors of pi. But here is one point where again, we recognize that k cannot be an arbitrary number. K has to be an integer. For this algebra to have a nice representation, of dimension k. And similarly, in the dual perspective, the area of the phase space must be an integer. Okay, so do you guys remember this discussion we had? Like, what do we get when we make momentum periodic? We found if we exponentiate the canonical commutation relations, we find this formula. And we found that there's a nice representation of dimension k. The representation can be visualized as follows. The algebra acts on the vector space spanned by the kth roots of unity. And one of them, p, multiplies by e to the 2 pi over k. So p moves you around. And q acts on the kind of mth state by e to the 2 pi I m over k. Okay. I guess, so our conclusion is the phase space of Chern-Simons theory is some compact manifold of finite area, and the Hilbert space is this finite dimensional vector space with this kind of explicit action of the Wilson lines. So I'd like to go on and discuss the non-abelian case. Unless there's any questions. No. Okay, so I do have a question for you guys. In any of your previous courses, did people explain like the Wilson line for a non-abelian gauge symmetry? No? Okay, this is a really basic and important thing, and it's slightly off topic, but I want to go through it in detail because you need to know this, you know, to claim to have any knowledge of quantum field theory. So in general, in any gauge theory, we can build an operator from the gauge field . So take some gamma s1 to orn. So orn is wherever our gauge theory happens to live. It could be any manifold. And then and we're going to consider a UN gauge theory. And then the claim is the trace of sum, let's call it CK, yeah, K greater than or equal to 0, integral This is gauge invariant. Okay, so what do we mean this by this expression? Well, I hope you should know what the pullback of a one-form is. Well, this is because this is a gauge field. It's a one-form. It's really a matrix of one-forms. So when I'm writing them in this particular order, implicit in this expression is matrix multiplication. So matrix multiplication of the UN indices is implicit. So this object is called the Wilson loop. If n equals 1, then the order doesn't matter. And this is the exponential of the integral over theta of gamma star a, maybe with a factor of I or something. You know, because if I have rank 1 matrices, the order in which I multiply matrices doesn't matter. And the reason you get the exponential is when I expand the exponential, I get a 1 over k factorial. And that corresponds to the different ways of ordering those thetas. So here's the proof that it's gauge invariant. So I suppose I do a gauge variation. That then the Wilson loop and somewhere in the middle, I'm going to have like a d chi plus a chi. And Sorry, I need to. The argument is extremely trivial. I'm just blanking for a sec. Yeah, so integration by parts, the dechi term doesn't matter. Except for boundary terms. So if we look at this dechi, you know, I integrate by parts and move the d around. You know, here we're using the fact that d gamma star a equals 0 because we're in dimension 1 and there's no two forms. So when I move the d around, I'm just going to pick up some boundary terms. The boundary terms are where some theta I equals theta I plus 1 are theta 1 equals 0, or theta n equals 1. Well, let's not to worry too much about the difference between this type of boundary term and this type of boundary term, because I'm taking the trace, there's a cyclic symmetry, and in fact, they can all be treated in the same way. So let's focus on some theta I equals theta I plus 1. Then A theta I wedge gamma star A theta I is equal to 0. As these are one forms, in one variable, so the only relevant boundary terms are where I'm really not explaining this very well. We draw a little picture. And here is d chi. The boundary terms are where this point, labeled by d chi, hits the previous or subsequent point. Okay. So I didn't explain this very well. This is extremely simple. I have this coordinate, which I'm integrating over, and it has a derivative in it. So I just pick up the boundary terms, whether it hits this or hits this. So the boundary terms give me some kind of sum like this, where I have a chi a minus A chi A. So this point hits from the right and hits from the left, and they do this with opposite signs. But this is exactly the same as the contribution of the other term like this should be a minus, should be a plus. Up to sign. So the gauge variation has two terms, one of which I replace A by its commutator, and the other of which I add on this derivative. The boundary terms for the derivative and this, they're just the same. And so they cancel. And one needs a little care with the initial and final. There's a small amount of care with the initial and final conditions where this hits there, but that's taken care of by the fact that we're using the trace and it's cyclically symmetric, so in fact it's all the same. Okay. So what is the meaning of a Wilson loop? So a Wilson loop is actually a very concrete thing. You can make one in your kitchen. This is time. Space. So here we have two very heavy particles of opposite charge. So for times before this, because the charges cancel, this is, say, electromagnetism. But something similar will happen for non-abelian gauge theory. For times before this, the charges cancel and they don't really do anything. And then I separate them. And then I bring them back together. So in this region, they're separated and they have some effect. That's what the Wilson loop is. Probably a better way to interpret it, rather than saying you have two very heavy things of opposite charge, is that you're creating things of opposite charge from the vacuum, and then they move around, and then they come back together. So I'd like to explain why is this true. So consider a heavy particle, charged particle, which is coupled to U1 gauge theory. So it moves on some path. So because it's charged, the Hilbert space is some representation of un, and we take it to be c to the n. If the fundamental representation. Now, when I say the Hilbert space is C to the n, I'm not thinking the particle is not really free to move around by itself. It's kind of on some fixed trajectory, then just has that Hilbert space. You know, like an electron would have C too. So what does it mean to couple? Coupling to gauge theory means that the Hamiltonian is my gauge field, A, restricted to gamma. So this is going to be some kind of time dependent so, in Maxwell theory, this is really how the potential couples to some charged particle in this way. So, what we'll find is that if we study how a state evolves, the evolution of a state is given by this formula, and that will tell us that because a particle moves in a circle, the effect of having this particle is the same as inserting this function of the gauge field. So if I take my initial state I'm going to use coordinates t instead of theta, then t, the time derivative is the pullback of this times psi. So this equation is solved by saying psi t is sum So why does this solve this equation? This is very easy. So let me draw a little picture. Where's my initial state? Oh, and I need to put my initial state here. And this actually should go the other order. So I have my initial state, and then a bunch of A's. And here is T. When I differentiate with respect to t, I pick up a term from the boundary of the integral where this hits there. And this is then, tk hits capital T. T times some integral Okay, is that clear? You guys unhappy? I mean, of course, this formula is as old as time, right? Wilson did not invent this. This is probably Euler, presumably, knew about how to solve these differential equations. okay, so we're just about done. So if our particle moves in a circle, you know, it goes forward and backwards in time, then we should trace over the Hilbert space of the particle which is Cn. And this gives us the Wilson loop. Okay, so I want to say one more thing in this direction. Quick historical comment. I think Wilson's interest in this was because of this picture. You take something, heavy things created from the vacuum, and then they come back. I don't quite... I don't quite recall how it goes, but he had some argument that says, if quarks confine, then by thinking about this picture with heavy particles, you'll see that the expectation value of a Wilson loop should go like e to the minus the area. But as I don't quite recall how he does that, but that might be a fun thing to look up where that argument comes from. So the final thing I wanted to say in this vein is the field strength has a very natural interpretation in this language. Which is going to be really useful when we study Trin-Simons theory. So we have the field strength. It's some matrix. It's in UN, and it depends on IJ, which are space-time indices. So consider a small square in space-time, like this. It starts at some point x, and here, this is the I direction, and this is the J direction, and the length of the sides is, say, delta. It's a square in the IJ plane. Then we can consider a Wilson loop on this square. Where we do not take the trace. And then the claim is that the Wilson loop looks like delta squared times the field strength plus higher order terms. Okay, so the geometric meaning of the field strength is I take a very small loop in space-time, and I have a little particle moving around there, and I measure what it is. So this is why is this? This is very easy to see, but Let's see. Draw my little square. So at order delta squared, we can have 1 or 2 points on the square. So there's contributions from one point moving around, plus contributions from 2 points. These correspond to dA plus half a terms. So let me very quickly, I don't think I have time to derive the second term. It's kind of a fun little exercise to go through in my 2 points. They can go on various ways and some things cancel at order delta squared. But we can quite easily check that this term is indeed dA. So we have, this goes in the j direction, I direction, this, and I'm integrating around the square, and this contribute with opposite signs. Because one I'm integrating this way and the other I'm integrating this way. If I look at the difference between them, a on the top line minus a on the bottom line is like delta d dxj of a I. Because I'm moving them in the j direction, because I'm integrating along this direction, I'm picking up the I component. Because the when I integrate, the side is of length delta, what the integral gives delta squared. DAj, so dAi dxj. And the two vertical lines give delta squared dAj dxi. You can see the signs are opposite because here I'm coming down. So we get minus aj, this one. And so if I put the two of them together, the total contribution is delta squared del ai del xj minus del aj dxi. Okay, so for the other ones, maybe you can say verbally, if you think we're working to order delta squared, and because the length of each side is delta, and I'm doing two integrals, we can treat the values of them as being the same, because the difference between the value here and the value here will be the next order in delta. So, in particular, I get a contribution where I have AI, AJ from these two things minus this one. And that's the commutator. That's the outer term. And that's the only contribution because there's some fiddling around to check that the outer contributions all cancel. Okay, so I'll stop there. And any questions?
Could you repeat why the proof of the gauge invariance of the Lusso loop would require dA to be zero?
Sorry about that. I mean, I wasn't being very clear about that point. You don't actually. It's much simpler. You just have one point which has a derivative on it, and you pick up the boundary for that coordinate. Yeah, that coordinate is integrated from like theta I plus 2.
Oh, okay.
That's it. So.
Kevin, do you know reference for this stuff, transignments and the Wilson loops?
Wilson loops is very standard material. It'll be in Nakahara. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this expression I learned in some grad school lecture 20 years ago, I don't know. Transignment theory is less kind of thoroughly documented, but yeah, I think you would have just as good luck as me. Just try to search on the archive. Somebody probably has lecture notes on transignments theory.
I'm trying to read more on this. So like
Greg Moore or?
Greg.
What's his?
He has lecture notes. Yeah, exactly.
Just on transignments theory? Ah, okay. Well, I should try to look at those. Maybe I can try and coordinate with them. I didn't know about that.